This is the Sophia Mare Studios podcast.
A woman may read a Game of Thrones.
A woman may start a podcast.
Two women may host Podcasters Landing, the show devoted to the entire A Song of Ice and Fire series.
Two women may cover three chapters each week, followed by history and friendship lessons.
A listener may sit and tune in.
A woman may use adult language.
A woman may reveal spoilers.
A listener may support the show on our Patreon page at patreon.com/Sophia Mayer Studios, all under case.
A woman welcomes a listener to Podcaster's Landing.
Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Nat.
And today we are covering A Game of Thrones, Daenerys, Catelyn, and Tyrion. I know you haven't visited your favorite character in so long.
Yeah, but I mean, it was more her interacting with Rob, and we had more of an insight on what's going on with Rob. So I didn't mind that one much, because it's not too much about her doing stupid things, even though she caused all of this.
I'm assuming she'll become more tolerable in her position as being an advisor to Rob, and like not constantly, you know, reminded of why did she take Tyrion? That was so dumb.
Yeah, I mean, after this, even though, yeah, in the back, you know, everything was her fault, but after Ned dies, she becomes a bit more tolerable because she does make good decisions.
Mm-hmm. But first, we are back with Daenerys. Which, the last time we saw Daenerys, was Khal Drogo had killed her brother with molten gold.
Mm-hmm. Or as her handmaids say, crowned.
Yeah.
Khal Drogo crowned Viserys.
The cart king.
Yeah, the cart king.
Yep. And so we return with Daenerys just when Khal Drogo has finished screwing her.
Mm-hmm. Lovely.
Or as the Brits would say, finished shagging her.
Yes. Yeah. Shagging, plowing.
Have it off.
That maybe. Noshing. Noshing is another one. when you have it off with someone, I guess it's just like, it's like you're making out, but a bit more than that. So yeah. I guess like, for you guys would be like,
got off. Yeah.
Yeah. Noshing is a good one. I like noshing.
Yeah. And so we're like, so Danny's trying to persuade Khal Drogo to go beyond the Narrow Sea to Westeros. And Khal Drogo's just like, why would we do that? We have Stallion Who Mounts the World has no need of iron chairs.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And again, it taps into the cultural aversion of the Dothraki to the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just interesting, again, naturally, as such a, you know, the Dothraki, the Great Grass Sea, they're such an inland tribe, and like they're just not a seafaring culture in any way, shape, or form. And as Jorah will say later, like the most that Drogo is envisioning, that even if there are some islands beyond, you know, westward, that they would only, their like resources and what they could plunder would be very minimal, not realizing that there's like a whole like continent.
As he says here that the end of the the earth ends at the Black Salt Sea, so anything beyond that doesn't exist for him, you know.
Yeah,
but the thing is, how long is it going to be until he just pillages everything? So then there's nowhere else to go.
Yeah, and it's like, we will speak no more of wooden horses and iron chairs. This day I will go to grass and hunt woman wife.
Woman wife. I like when he calls her woman wife.
Yes. Yes, my sun and stars, Danny said. Yeah. So he goes off hunting for the great white lion.
Mm-hmm.
And what does it say of the white lion and then rut and then, oh, it's a Calamity laughter, but just the white lion, any sort of allusions with the Lannisters? I don't know. We'll see.
That is true. That is true. But, you know what? It does remind me of the fact that, you know, he goes off to hunt this, like, mystic, I guess mystic, but, like, that still exists. Something that is just, like,
legendary, strong. Shall we say.
Yeah, legendary. And Robert went off to find that the legendary, it wasn't the boar, because they went out to get something else, wasn't it?
Was it a white stag? Was it prongs?
I don't think it was prongs. It was something along those lines, but they couldn't find it because, like, someone else killed it. So then they went for, like, they heard about the boar.
Yep.
But there is, like, some sort of correlation there, because then, you know, Khal Drogo does come back with the white lion.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously Robert died, so.
Yep. So Drogo goes off hunting, as men are wont to do.
Mm-hmm.
And Danny, like, calls in Jorah, and he's like, you know, make Drogo understand that that the Westeros is, like, worthwhile to, you know, because Jorah explains, like, you know, they just don't know any better, and they would think going eastward is much more, like, a larger investment, but,
yeah.
Yep, yeah, Dorth, we will go home, I promise you, home, the world made her word made her feel sad. Ser Jorah had his bare island, but what was home to her? A few tales, names, and recited as solemnly as the words of a prayer, the fading memory of a red door. Was Vast Dothrak to be her home forever? When she looked at the crones of the Dosh Khalin, was she looking at her future?
Yeah, she's not very keen on being there. And the thing is, she's sort of correlating, you know, the red door with the Seven Kingdoms, but it's not, like, she doesn't know what the Seven Kingdoms are. Yeah, I mean, what the Seven Kingdoms is. I can't speak English. Me no speak English. Yeah, so she doesn't know what, but she is sort of, I guess, trying to put, you know, the Red Door in the same realm as the Seven Kingdoms to conjure up this made up fantasy of that is her home.
Yeah, and it's, so finally Jorah's like, why don't you come to the market, like the Western market, and Danny's like, yes, I would like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, so Danny is basically carried out because she's heavily pregnant.
Yeah.
So
so the people who go with her is young men and her handmaidens, because I guess everyone else from the Khalasar is either chilling out or they are going hunting with Khal Drogo.
Mm-hmm.
So they all go to the Western market, which Danny really likes.
Yeah, so nothing like a good bout of retail therapy.
Yeah, exactly. For me, recently has been books, and I need to stop that. You know, I had to, like, unsubscribe from the bookshop emails because I'm just like, they keep sending me suggestions of what you might like. I was like, don't, I can't see it.
Yeah, I phase between books and fashion, so I've phased out of books, and now my thing is fashion. Mm. And the good thing is that I can keep a lid on it by going to Goodwill and charity shops, and I got a really nice pair of, like, business slacks, like business pants, for like $5, and they're so awesome.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But anyway,
it's nice to feel like a big boss lady. You know, that's when you buy, like, office clothes, and you feel like a proper, like,
boss bitch.
Yeah, I don't wear those clothes anymore. I'm always in, like, my, like, what do you guys call it, sweats?
Sweats and pajamas.
Yeah, that's pretty much how I am.
Yeah, and I'm that way when, again, I'm in a hybrid working situation, so I partake in both, but also I will sometimes go to a coffee shop and work and be a fabulous boss bitch, but specifically a boss bitch, not to be confused with girl boss, because there's been a lot of criticism of that term, girl boss.
Oh yeah, no, girl bosses are like the ones from the pyramid scheme, aren't they?
I don't know necessarily. A lot of people just think it's demeaning to like diminish a woman, you know, in authority by calling her a girl and that sort of thing. So I always opt for boss bitch.
Yeah, boss bitch is better, I think.
Anyway.
But yeah, we digress. So she goes off
therapy aside. So she's talking about, you know, the Eastern market has like all like the zebras and all sorts of wondrous animals and is very exotic. But for her, the Western market is, again, it's not even reminiscent because she's never lived in Westeros. It's just this fantasy she has constructed about where she belongs and who she is. And she literally says, if I were not the blood of the dragon, this could be my home. She was Khaleesi. She had strong men. Like, yeah, she's basically a queen. She has handmaids to serve her, warriors to keep her safe, an honored place in the Dosh Kalin awaiting her when she grew old, and in her womb grew a son who would one day bestride the world. That should be enough for any woman, but not for the dragon. So what do you think about this returning, especially in the context of where the show went, chose to go?
Yeah, I think that after Viserys was, you know, like how Drogo killed Viserys, she sort of internalized everything that he was saying and took it upon herself to, like, be the dragon. So I think that's when, like, her madness and her obsession started. I think it was at this point where she took that responsibility of being the last dragon, in quotes.
Yeah.
And started running with it.
Yeah, I tend to think that if two things. One, if this assassination attempt that we will read soon had not taken place, if she had more time to like ruminate and more time to like, you know, just live her life with the Dothraki and not constantly hear Viserys's dreams and ambitions, I think there may have been a point where she'd be like, yeah, screw the Seven Kingdoms. I'm fine right where I am. But there also is the sense of, would she ever be okay? Like, okay, I'm going to stay in Essos and do my thing when the dragons are hatched. Because I think the sort of interpretation is that if I'm the dragon and dragons have hatched, then it is my destiny, my divine right to be like a Targaryen queen of Westeros, like, you know, all my family used to be. And then there's a scenario that even if the dragons did hatch and the assassination did and take place, could she be swayed to be like, no, I'm not dealing with Westeros if Khal Drogo was still alive?
I still think she would try to go to Westeros because of the dragons hatching. Then it would definitely like go into her head, like, we need to do this. Like, I am definitely the last dragon because look, I've got three dragons here and they hatched for me. Mm-hmm. So we need to conquer and go back to the place where it was my seat. It was my family seat that got taken away from me.
Yeah. So yeah, definitely with the dragons, they're sort of like a spiritual borderline dogmatic, you know, sense of duty and fate and all of those things. But I think also even without the dragons, just the fact that the assassination attempt happens, I think, you know, regardless of if Dany was susceptible to being content, I think she realizes that clearly they're not going to leave me alone. Even if I chose to just be a Khaleesi and be happy where I am, they're not going to leave me alone. So it's like, fuck it, I'm going to do it, because there's no middle ground where they're just gonna like, you know, have a ceasefire or whatever.
Yeah for sure. Well, and at that point she obviously doesn't know that Robert's dead either, so that was a word that got sent out before he died, and I guess no one got the memo that he passed away just yet. So, you know, they wouldn't, because you know, I don't know if they know, but I don't think Cersei gives a shit about what's going on that side.
Yeah, very narrow-minded. And so Dany's pondering all this and enjoying the Western markets where they have the special sausages that she likes, although they're not made with pork, they're made with horse meat because that's what's available. and her like bodyguards are like, you know, have to outdo each other with how many sausages they eat until one of them belches loudly.
I think it was the fact that they said that it was a horse meat that they were like, okay, I'll eat this, because they didn't want to eat it before. They were just like, oh, what is this? But then also, you know, something that we didn't touch upon is that the fact that like Jorah went with them.
Yeah,
but Jorah was like, oh, I must see her. I must see someone.
I need to go like check the mailbox. I'll be right back.
Yeah, yeah. And then she's like, oh, I'll go with you. And he's like, no, don't. So it's like, you're acting funny.
Yeah, and she honestly takes it off to brushes it off as maybe he wants to go to a whorehouse afterwards.
Yeah, yeah. Which there's, I mean, of course. She wouldn't think that he's sort of betraying her, would she?
No, like he can do his own thing. She is just, it's not that way. She's just surprised that he's being so quote unquote shy about it. Because yeah. And I'm just, and it just, this also makes me think of, you know, where was Jorah's evolution in deciding that I'm going to switch to, you know, be, like, I just don't see it being where he read this letter, realizing that someone like is, or like a plot is in place right now to kill her. And then, oh my God, I feel bad, and runs to save her from the poisoned wine. I'm assuming like that it was kind of before that. And he only happened to get the word that this particular plot was coming in place.
But I mean, why would he act so funny? You know, why would he act so funny in the market if he had realized? I think it happened there and then when he got the letter and read it. Then he was just like, oh shit.
Yeah.
You know?
Like,
or even, you know, he might have got the letter. It could, because didn't Varys say that they were talking to him, to Jorah, about assassinating her? So mm-hmm. they sent like, so maybe he's just like, no, it's my kill and it's my pardon to get. Maybe it was still there, and maybe he still wasn't.
Yeah, I wish we had access to that email thread.
I know, it would have been good. And like access to like his thoughts, because we don't really get an insight on like him much, on Jorah much, do we?
Yeah, because it's, because in terms of his protection, like of the eggs, you know, from Viserys and not stealing the from Dany, like, you know, you could interpret it either way of that, you know, becoming more protective of Dany, even from her own brother, or, you know, again, just self-serving of letting Viserys be his self-destructive self to the point of him dying and no one has to do it for them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, you know, at the end of the day, if he killed her, he could have just, like, taken the eggs with him to sell it. By his way back,
yeah,
into Westeros. So yeah, not entirely sure.
But he pieces out. They're all enjoying sausages and everyone's laughing. Dany buys Doria or one of them like a fertility charm. All of them are having fun, laughing, giggling, and I guess this is supposed to be the sort of, you know, the window into the fantasy scenario of if Dany had decided that I'm just going to be a Khaleesi and that's okay, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, and, but then that fantasy is swiftly drawn to a close because they stop by a wine merchant.
And, you know, he doesn't realize who she is just yet. He just, you know, he knows that she's a Khaleesi.
No, she's a Khaleesi. It's first put off by the fact that she speaks Valyrian, and then that she's Westerosi. And then her one of her handmaids properly introduces her as, like, Khaleesi of the Great Grassy and Princess to the Seven Kingdoms.
And then he's like, because he was trying to sell her some wine from, like, a Dornish wine, a sweet red from Dorne. He's like, oh, no, this is rubbish. I will give you something better than this. I have a whole cask for you. And she thinks it's sweet because, you know, Khal Drogo really likes fancy wine, I guess.
Really likes fancy wine. And yeah, she just thinks he's very, you know. Again, it's a sad thing because she's constructed this fantasy that just by saying she's from the Sunset Kingdoms, that she's naturally, that naturally fellow Westerosis are going to be like her friend, or at least a comrade.
Yeah, it's that internalized thing again that, you know, Viserys put in her head that there's people in Westeros waiting for them to come back. Yeah.
Yep. And then, but before they can take the casket of wine, Ser Jorah comes. You know, I just see him running with like his arms being like, no.
Yeah. He's just like, absolutely no way. It says that his voice was strange and brusque. How'd you say it? Brusque. Yeah, not brusque. What?
Yeah. And then we've got Ser Jorah. Something wrong? I have a thirst. Open it, wine cellar. And so, you know, I don't, again, like, did it state in plain language in the letter he just read that it was going to be a poisoning attempt, or like, I don't know, but yeah, he's just like, open it, like, and drink it.
Yeah, maybe it's not, I think even if the person is a Khaleesi, it's not very, usual for someone to give someone a whole cask of wine. You know, because, you know, I think a page or two back, it says, you know, when she was buying stuff for her handmaidens, she was, you know, giving coin back, which is the art of buying. That she says, like, that the Dothraki taught her, which is weird because the Dothraki just pillages and steals.
Yeah, but like, anyway, they don't. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, none of these people were giving it for free to her because she's a Khaleesi. So maybe that's what was suspicious for giving, like, the wine. But then, yeah, he might have had an insight on the fact that it would be poison or something that couldn't be traced back to anyone in particular.
Mm-hmm. Which, yeah, so Jorah insists for the wine cellar to drink it, and Dany seems to go along with it, and it's like, drink it or I will hold you down and pour it down your throat.
Yeah.
And he reaches for the cup and grabs the cask instead, flinging it at her with both hands. Ser Jorah bowled into her, knocking her out of the way. The casket bounced off his shoulder and smashed open to the ground. And Dany almost falls, but Doria catches her.
Yeah, she almost falls on her belly as well, but so she lands on her legs instead.
Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, so they capture the merchant, and just everyone is Danny's near tears as they carried her back. And tell me, was it the usurper? Yes, the knight drew out a folded parchment, a letter to Viserys from Magister Illyrio. Robert Baratheon offers lands and lordships for your death or your brother's.
And then she says that the usurper owes Drogo a lordship then.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Drogo killed him. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And then, I forgot this happens at this moment, she's just like, Ser Jorah, light the brazier.
Yeah, because she had like this thinking that, well, it says here the usurper had woken the dragon now, and she had like this thing in her head that if she put them in the fire, they might hatch. Yeah, where did that come from? I don't know.
I don't know either. Yeah, we have the dragon's eggs. Your brother Rhaegar was the last dragon. What had she expected 1,000 years ago? They had been alive, but they were only pretty walks. They could never make a dragon. A dragon was air and fire, living flesh, not dead stone.
Yeah.
Yeah, again. I hope I one day find a bunch of bones with some fossilized dinosaur eggs that end up hatching and being my dragon eggs, and I will be mother of dragons.
Well, pterodactyls, I guess, are sort of dragons. They just don't breathe fire.
Yeah.
But then Drogo comes back.
Yep.
He's really happy because he caught the lion, and he said that he's going to make her a cloak of its skin.
Yep. And he's so happy, so proud, and then Dany tells him what happens.
And Jorah, she fills him in, and then Jorah says, you know, the poisoner was the first, but he will not be the last. Men will risk much for lordship. And so Drogo is really grateful for Drogo and Jorah, and they gave him, like, you can pick whatever horse you want, apart from, you know, my horse and Silver.
Dany's. Yeah, like that is, I'm assuming that is the highest honor that a Khal can bestow within the context of the Dothraki culture. And then he's like, and then he finally says, as Antu Rhaego, son of Drogo, the stallion who will mount the world, to him I also pledge a gift. To him I will give this iron chair his mother's father sat in. I will give him the second kingdoms. I, Khal Drogo, will do this thing. His voice raised as he lifted his fist to the sky. I will take my Khalasar west to where the worlds end and ride the wooden horses across the black salt water and no Khal has done before. I will kill the men in their iron suits and tear down their stone houses. I will rape their women, take their children as slaves, and bring their broken gods back to Vast Dothrak to bow down beneath the mother of the mountains. This I vow, I, Drogo, son of Barbo. This I swear before the mother of mountains as the stars look down in witness.
That bit in the show was so well done. Was so well done. It's
Yeah, like
crazy.
that. And that was the point, you know, because it was a really long monologue that was, again, for cematic effect, was given in the Dothraki invented language. And that's the time when I realized that, oh, the whoever made this language knew Arabic, because it's like, Anna ve chakason kais aishe mai.
There's a lot of the there, aren't they? The
Yeah, so, and honestly, you know, most of, you know, nearly all of Jason Momoa's lines were in Dothraki, to the point that, like, certain, like, it took him a little bit to, like, you know, use Game of Thrones as a springboard for his career, because a lot of people thought he didn't speak English.
People thought that it was a real language and he didn't speak any English because he did it so well. He did it so well. But yeah, so then they left Vest Dothrak 2 days later, striking south and west across the plains. So he's pissed now. He has like
Yeah,
lost that.
he's it's interesting again that we it's kind of sh it's one thing for to say that, oh, we will speak no more of stallions, or I mean, speak no more of iron chairs and wooden horses, and then I'd say, and a few weeks later, Danny went to the market. But literally, this 180 happens in one day,
But
which
she's
I
so pissed.
Yeah, because I think he's, yeah, more from being, I think it's more his manly pride has been wounded about, you know, you going after, you know, his woman, and it's just like, oh, you, like, I didn't care that much about this, but okay, fuck you, bitches.
That's exactly it. It's like you have put my family in danger, so I'm gonna fuck you up.
Yes, so, and a lot of people will comment, like, I wish I had a man to make declarations like that for me, minus raping the children or raping
They
the
want a
women.
part of Khal Drogo, not the whole thing.
And while while they're marching south and west, 2 days later, the wine seller hurried behind them, naked on foot, chained at throat and wrist, were fastened to the halter of Dany's silver.
And that's where the chapter ends. Wasn't it in the TV show? They kill him. Khal Drogo kills him, doesn't he?
No, they show him. They show him chained to the horse
Oh,
as
okay.
Danny's riding. He probably died at some point, but that was a part of his punishment.
I just forget because the last few seasons of the book of the book of the TV show just completely went crazy. That I forget that like the first few
The first, like, first
seasons are
three.
so like that's
Loyal.
so right. Very loyal.
Indeed. So, and then we have Catelyn. Who is basically coming to Rob's camp with her tail between her legs because she's had to release Tyrion. She's getting no help from Lysa in any way, shape, or form. And armies and men and resources aside, she even offers to have little Robin in the show, you know, be fostered at Winterfell. And she's like, it'll be good for him to be with, like, my boys. And Lysa is just like screamed at her. It's like, you know, I will destroy you if I will throw you in
out of the moon door.
Out of the moon door if you steal my son.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, all right then, fine. Mm-hmm. Keep your weird child.
Keep your weird child. And so she's coming up to, was it Moat Cailin? Moat Cailin, which doesn't look like much, but it is a very strategic geopolitical point to have, because even though it doesn't look like much, like the three towers are perfect for archers, and even anyone who wants to get through it, it's like a bog, it's a swamp, you have to get through quicksand and lizard lions, aka alligators and crocodiles, I presume.
Yeah, I think
so. Oh my god,
too.
My, you know, screw spiders and snakes, like my husband can deal with them. He absolutely hates alligators.
I have a thing with snakes. I hate them. Like,
you hate
it was when my mom was married, her husband's nephew had a pet snake, and he used to let the pet snake just like roam around his bedroom freely. And I would not, when we would go to their house, I would not go to the bathroom in their house, because that's like how scared I am of snakes. I just like, it makes me feel so sick. Like, I watch a snake on TV, it makes me feel sick, and I want to cry.
Oh, that's the Catholic imagery of the snake as Satan.
Yeah, I rebuke Satan, apparently, I guess. but it's like, you know, yeah, watching Harry Potter when Nagini is there, it's just a no for me.
I'm pretty cool with snakes, obviously, as long as they're not venomous. You would not do well, like, going hiking with me, because in the super hot months in August, when it gets, like, 80 plus degrees, there are a few, like, they're harmless, you know, but quite large black garter snakes.
That is an absolute no. I will not go hiking. I will not go hiking with you.
And and then there was one instance where I was looking at my phone or listening to music, somewhat distracted, and then literally I had to stop 3 feet, and the snake was like, yeah, and then scurried away.
it fell in front of you.
Like it was kind of coiled up, and then I got 3 feet, and then suddenly I stopped, and then it like went like kind of jerked in the air, and then went and then slithered away.
Oh my god. Oh, that makes me feel sick. Oh my god. Oh, that makes me feel so ill. And there was a time where I went to I went to Mexico, and we were looking at we went to like some Mayan ruins, and we were there like taking pictures and stuff, and then I just overheard the guide on like a tour group next to me being like, "Oh, just be careful with the snakes." And I just whipped my head around to the person who was in that tour group. And I said, "Did he just say, be careful with the snakes?" And they were like, "Yeah." And I'm like, right, I'm getting the fuck out of here. I tried to, you know, carry on a little bit. But there was this one bit. So there was like a pyramid here. And then there was like, you had to go through this like, you know, like grassy area to go to like another set of ruins and pyramid, and I just couldn't do it because I was just so aware of like
the snakes in the grass.
I was just like, there it is. And then as I was coming back, the guy who I asked, did the guy just say, be careful with the snakes, just said, "Oh, there's a snake back there. We just saw a snake back there." And I was just like, get me the fuck out of here. And I just got lost. I lost myself in that bit, and I was nearly crying, and I found a way out finally, and I just waited out there. I can't do it. It's just...
What about Chamber of Secrets with the Basilisk?
The Basilisk is fine because I know it's not real.
Oh, but Nagini could be real? Or is real?
Well, yeah.
Oh. Yeah.
You know, so, there's like anacondas, right?
Yes. Oh, that's why you freaked out when I told you, like, Megalodon, that there was a huge, like, 50-foot-long anaconda that once existed in prehistoric times.
Yeah, that is fucking nasty. That is nasty as hell. That's just disgusting. It makes my skin crawl. I feel sick. Ugh. Get me out of here. Get me out of this hell.
All right. Anyway, so my husband is basically that with alligators, and we live near a lake, in Indiana, but we could never replicate this scenario in like in the South, in like the Southern states in any way, because there's no way my husband would want to live near a lake where the alligators could be popping out.
Yeah.
Like there's
bless him.
Yeah, there's a viral video of this black guy, again, in the South, who literally wrangles an alligator with a plastic recycling rolly bin.
Oh my god.
Like he traps it into the recycling bin.
Holy shit.
And he's like just,
the one with the cat is just batting at the alligator. The cat just going like,
yeah.
And then the end of the alligator just shrinks, just slinks away back in the water.
Yeah, but anyway, so yeah, Moat Cailin, lots of alligators / crocodiles, lots of quicksand, just, you know, and in the and typical like Yorkshire bog style, at night there's ghosts.
Oh yeah.
More ghosts than sheep.
Yeah, ghosts, cold, vengeful spirits of the north who hunger for southern blood.
So yeah, so this is the place where Rob has made his seat for now, and she's finally let in. And it just came to me, like, the people who are escorting Catelyn from White Harbor to this place, like Willis and your what are their last names?
Wendell.
The Manderleys, and like just with the walrus mustaches, I'm just like, you know, reminds me of Uncle Vernon.
Yeah. And he also reminds me of, you know, the guy who played Arthur Weasley. He gained a lot of weight after Harry Potter, and then he had, like, this mustache that made him look like a walrus as well.
Oh, dear. Yeah, I only, the only other thing that I, where he's a central character, that actor who played Arthur Weasley, is Father Brown. I love that show.
I never seen that. He's also in, 101 Dalmatians,
I want to say. He's one of the henchmen. I love it.
Yeah, I think it's 101 Dalmatians. Yeah,
it is. Yeah, with Glenn Close. He's one of the lackeys.
Yeah.
He's Boris. It's Boris and Jasper. Or Horace. Mm-hmm. Horace. So anyway, so Catelyn finally is led inside, and she finds Rob with all of the bannermen, like, you know, talking strategy and tactics. And the lords fell silent one by one, and Rob looked up at the sudden quiet and saw her, and he's like, "Mother," he said, his voice thick with emotion. And Catelyn wanted to run to him to kiss his sweet brow, but she wasn't. But she is smart enough not to shame him, you know, and emasculate him in front of all of his bannermen.
Yeah, at least she has some sense in that. She realizes that, you know, that will make him a laughing stock.
Which... You should be able to, like, hug your mother when you have, like, a huge direwolf at your side, but yeah.
I know, right? I know. He did, you know, don't laugh at me for kissing my mother, for saying hi to her.
Yeah, especially when my wolf just ripped two of
Great
Jog's fingers off.
Exactly. That's exactly it.
Yeah,
but you know, it just made me this interaction with her as well, like from the first time that he sees her, and then like his voice is thick with emotion, but also the fact that when they're having this conversation, once everyone leaves, it just feels to me like he's just playing at being a lord and he has no clue. Bless him. It just, you know, makes you feel really sad for him.
I think I'm a little more charitable, where I think he does have a sense of what he's doing, but naturally he is riddled with self-doubt because this is his first rodeo.
Yeah.
Because even Catelyn admits, you know, how impressed she is by, like, taking the best of Bolton's and, you know, Umber's, you know, strategy ideas.
Mm-hmm. And then he makes it his own as well. He listens to them, but he's like, I think that this would be the best. And she says, you know, he is like Ned.
Yeah, so he takes best of both and mitigates, you know, the risk as much as he can. And so, you know, well, and then before this, you know, Catelyn's just like, you know, you could have sent any of these bannermen in your stead. Why did you have to go? And it's just like, are you going to send me home? And I'm like, no, I can't. It's too late at this point. Which, also, I think maybe... She doesn't directly have a thought process that we see in reading this chapter, but maybe a part of her, what also is, like, you know, holding herself from, you know, claiming quote unquote maternal matriarchal authority, mm-hmm. is she sees how damaged her nephew is from Lysa.
Yeah.
Like just witnessing that so recently, I think maybe also has an impact of why she is so like gracious with Rob in this moment.
Yeah. Yeah. She feels more like a teacher. I feel like she has learned a lot, by being with Ned, and she's being sort of like a teacher to him instead of coddling him. But it's also the fact that she needs to accept now that they're, you know, he is the Lord of Winterfell and he needs to do his duty. What I find curious here is that she says, you know, when he asks her, are you sending me back to Winterfell? And she says, I should, you ought never to have left. And it's like, who are you talking to? Because you should have never left either. Like, you're just going around doing absolute stupid shit. You should have never left.
Yeah,
and
at least
like no one there with you, with like the youngest kids.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, Rob is doing what is quote unquote expected for him given the changing circumstances. She just went on a whole crazy tangent that is totally outside of propriety.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And you know, he is like doing something that she has caused at the end of the day. And he's there trying to, I mean, I guess not fix it because there's no way to fix it, but he is there battling because of the shit that she has done.
Yep. And so, yeah, so, you know, Catelyn is smart enough to realize that even though the letter from Sansa is written in Sansa's handwriting, mm-hmm. that it's not what how Sansa would, like, word it. Like, this is totally, you know, Cersei. Like, she's a hostage. There's no mention of Arya. No, Catelyn did not want to think what that might mean. Not now, not here. Mm-hmm. I had hoped if you still had the imp, a trait of hostages. But yeah, that's not going to be a thing. And so...
Yeah, so they think that maybe if they can capture Jaime, they can do an exchange then.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, when they do, if they do. But she's telling Rob, you need to win this.
Yeah.
Because, you know, don't you remember what happened to Elia, Martell, and the kids?
Yeah.
You know, there's like no going back from our family. Like, you have to win this.
Yeah, you have to win otherwise because you can't, you know. Yeah, it's just a big, big mess. And ultimately, Rob goes over his strategy that ultimately he is going to march south with some of his company and have that be the red herring for Tywin Lannister to meet them, but most of their mounted riders will divert east or west and specifically attack Jaime's troops, mm-hmm. Jaime's company head first, while Tywin is otherwise occupied with the main march on the King's Road.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the main thing is sort of to separate the two of them, to have sort of the river in between both, because mm-hmm. right now there are some ways that they can go that they will be trapped between Jaime and Tywin. Mm-hmm. So Rob is sort of leading Jaime away from Tywin.
Yeah, he's cutting Jaime off from the support of Tywin.
Yeah.
But for all of this to work, they need the use of the phrase.
Mm-hmm.
And Rob is just like, he is one of your father's bannermen. He can easily help us. And mm-hmm. Catelyn's like,
Yeah, it's like, you shouldn't trust him. You know, my father never trusted him, and nor should you. And he says, no, I won't. But what do you think?
Yeah,
it does. She thinks, yeah, it does work, but she thinks there might be something fishy there.
Yeah, or at least further complications. And then she also has a little bit of a critique of, you know, choosing the Great John to lead like the company, distracting Tywin, marching south. Mm-hmm. And Catelyn's like, you know, how do I critique this without wounding his pride or confidence? And isn't this what women always have to do?
Yeah, yeah. That is true. To like choose our words very carefully, to knock him off as a bitch or as bossy or as there's another one that is only applied for women as well. It's
nagging, domineering.
Yeah, all of those. You know.
Yeah,
and because it's just if a man said to him, if he was Ned telling him, you know, no, you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't be sending someone like that. Then he'll be like, oh, okay, he's a teacher. But with her, it would have been like, she's too suffocating, trying to take over and stuff.
And just the specific medieval context that, oh my God, a woman knows more about strategy than I do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is totally not within the archetypes of what they, you know, choose to construct their whole lives and worldviews by. But she is able, does the thing that women always do, and able to slowly walk him through it. And so he instead chooses Roose Bolton because he needs a Slytherin, not a Gryffindor.
Yes, exactly. You need the cunning and someone who's going to come in and smash everything all at once, which is what Greyjoy wants. Yeah, the way that she did it, I think it was very well done, I guess. If the point is to not wound his confidence. She did just say, you know, your father once told me that, who was it? Greyjoy was as fearless as any man he had ever known. And, you know, Rob's just like, oh yeah, you know, Grey Wind ate two of his fingers and he laughed about it. But then she goes, your father is not fearless. He's brave, but that is very different. So then she starts to, like, sort of guide him through real-life examples of, like, you know, just because you're fearless doesn't mean you have to be impulsive.
Yeah.
But, you know.
So it ends with Rob saying that she's gonna, that he, like, he'll arrange an escort for her to go back to Winterfell. And she's just like, I can't go back. My father may be dying behind the walls of Rhaetoron. My brother is surrounded by foes. I must go there.
You know where she must go? To Winterfell, where two of her small children are there by themselves. Okay.
One of them paralyzed.
One of them paralyzed. She doesn't even, like, I don't think she even knows, does she, that he's, like, awake? Because she left. Oh, no, she does know because, because Ned told her. It's like, your brother and your father are grown men who are seasoned in fighting. And, like, yeah, is it a shitty deal that your dad is dying? But, like, in back in those days, like, your duty is to your new family and not your old family. So what she needs to do is go to see her fucking children, her babies. Was like, one is 8 and the other one is 3 years old, understanding what the hell's going on.
Yeah, and not to, like, shit on Catelyn as, like, you know, because she's a woman, like, how dare she, like, gallivant all around when her, like, small children are away. Like, I don't see it from, like, that sort of, like, because she's a woman, she has to.
Oh, yeah, no, me neither.
But it is the sense of, it's, in a way, it's a little bit, it makes sense with Rob. It's basically she's thinking that I'm the smartest person in the room and these, and even though my son clearly has some sense of what he's doing, you know, and she already said, like, you know, these men could have led the charge without, you know, without you. But then she's saying that if you're here, then I need, like, she feels she has to be there to advise. Which, if Bran and Rickon were not alone by themselves in Winterfell, that may be the most rational choice.
Yes, of course, of course. Right now, it's like, at the end of the day, you don't leave a 3-year-old and an 8-year-old by themselves without parental supervision. Yeah, Maester Luwin is there. Yeah, there's, like, other people there. But they want their mum. They want a parent, not just their mum. They want a parent there. And the fact that she's, like, so close to them and just... it's just, she's just like, no, I'm not gonna go there. I would say the same thing if, like, she is smarter than Ned and Ned was able to go home. I would be like, yeah, let Ned go home because that's where he's supposed to be, you know. But they don't have that choice, and she has that choice. She literally has that choice of going back and staying with her kids.
And I think maybe that's also why she's kind of annoyed with Rob for leaving.
Yeah. Because, which is funny. You know, that's what I'm saying. Like, why are you being... He's a 15-year-old kid. Like, you should have been there as well to tell him no, to advise him not to go, and all the other people would be able to go.
Mm-hmm.
But she wasn't, because she's running around being a fucking idiot. And, like, because of her, her husband is imprisoned. Because of her, like, her son had to go to war, or, like, there is a war going on that other people could have, you know, got killed. But she still won't go home. She still won't go to see her kids. She's a fucking idiot. That's what I say about her.
Yeah. Thus it ends, and then we move on to Tyrion. Who, again, another campground, but not the Starks' armies, but the Lannisters' armies. Tyrion has finally made his way to his father's encampment, surrounded by mountain men, who keep telling him that if he's lying or double-crosses them, they will chop off his manhood and feed it to the goats.
Yeah, yeah. That's a Shagga that keeps telling him, which is nice. But Shagga's apparently... on the Gulf. Yeah, so he managed to get like 300, stone men.
Yeah.
To follow him back, which is great. You know, that's how you know that the guy's smart. You know, that he didn't even get killed by any of them. He's just like, trust me.
Yeah.
You're gonna get a bunch of things.
And so they reach the encampment, they're kind of arguing, and Tyrion basically says, like, the leader's like, you, you're gonna come with me into the camp. The rest of you are gonna sit your asses down and wait.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Because, you know, he can't be marching in there with 300 people. They're gonna think that it's a war. Right? It's like, yeah. You know.
Mm-hmm. And so they go into the camp. And what was it? There was someone was hanging off whatever.
Oh, yeah. So, basically, Tywin is camping. He's not camping. He took residence up in the innkeep where Tyrion got captured. And Tyrion thinks that that is the... That it, you know, it's...
Has irony, poetic irony to it.
Yeah, it's the irony. So when he approaches the inn, is the innkeeper, the woman with the red teeth that Katniss said used to scare her. So she is hanging there, and like the crows have picked her skin.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it says the birds had eaten her lips and eyes and most of her cheeks, bearing her stained red teeth in a hideous smile. And then he says, yeah, a room, a meal, and a flagon of wine. That was all I asked.
Yeah, it's kind of reminds me of the Joker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
It's a very ominous feeling.
Yep, and so we finally get this interaction between Tyrion and Tywin, which...
Yeah, yeah, we heard stories about...
We've heard, you know, stories.
Tywin not liking him very much, and he not liking his dad, but then we finally get to see it firsthand, how they interact with each other.
Indeed, and Tyrion is... It's one thing to be able to put on this show of like humor and cynicism and sarcasm to like everyone else, but the fact that even Tyrion can maintain that sort of demeanor in front of his own father as well, you know, says something. And I just find it interesting that, you know, they knew he was a dwarf like from the beginning. So it's funny that Tyrion is given like the TY name, like, you know, because it's Tyrion, then it's Tywin, then it's Tytos. I'm just, you know, it's just interesting. Why wasn't Jaime given the traditional, like, T name associated with Lannisters? Why was it given to Tyrion when Tyrion is such an embarrassment to them?
Yeah, that is very interesting. Maybe that was the name that their mother chose. And that's, Tywin is trying to honor that.
Yeah, that is very, very possible. And again, I'm no expert on like dwarfism or anything, so I don't know like if it's obviously apparent, you know, from birth or whatever, you know.
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, obviously right now it is. You can tell. But back in the day, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, but anyway, so yeah, so kudos to Tyrion for being able to like keep up, you know, this banter with his father and use this sort of humor as a sort of like psychological armor.
Yeah, yeah. But you know, it does say here, when he walks in, it says here, Lord Tywin did not stir from his chair, but he did give his dwarf son a long searching look. I see that the rumors of your demise were unfounded. Sorry to disappoint you, father. Tyrion said, no need to leap up and embrace me. I wouldn't want you to strain yourself. He crossed the room to their table, acutely conscious of the way his stunted legs made him waddle with every step. Whenever his father's eyes were on him, he became uncomfortably aware of all his deformities and shortcomings. So he is, like, really aware. It bothers him when he's around his dad. When he's not around his dad, he's just like, yeah, that's what I am, and that's fine.
Yeah.
But with his dad, he just feels really, like, inaccurate, inappropriate, I guess, to be just in the presence of his father.
Yeah, by my lights, it was you who started this, Lord Tywin replied. Your brother Jaime would never have meekly submitted to capture at the hands of a woman. That's one way we differ, Jaime and I. He's taller as well. You may have noticed.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So just going through the whole thing of, you know, Tyrion and Tywin makes no, you know, aims to pretend that, you know, Tywin starting up this shit in response to Tyrion's capture is not for Tyrion itself. It's just for the, like, name of how dare you. Like, even our stupid little imp, like, you don't do shit against Lannisters unless you want hell coming down on you.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, I guess, maybe it's just an excuse as well.
Yeah,
because Cersei hated Ned. Jaime was aware of that, and it was just, everything was just an excuse, really. I mean, Jaime liked Tyrion, so he might have started shit just because of that. But Cersei was using that to just hate on the Starks even more. And yeah, everything just builds up. And yeah, if, like, you know, at the end of the day, when Jaime ran to Casterly Rock, he probably said, well, after he injured Ned, then Tywin was like, well, shit's gonna go down the drain now, so we might as well just go for it and start a war.
So they start to discuss strategy, and Tywin's just like, Frey only takes the field when the scent of victory is in the air, and all he smells is ruin. So definitely he has a better read of Frey than even Rob does, and even maybe to some extent than Catelyn.
Yeah. Yeah. She has, you know, she has obviously an inkling that he's a bit iffy. But yeah, Tywin knows that Walder Frey goes where victory is certain. So he won't do anything just yet. Yeah. What I find interesting is that obviously Tyrion has no idea what's going on.
Because
he's been away for a while.
He's been away. So he finds out that Robert Baratheon is dead. And so that he knows that by default, and that means Cersei is ruling, and says, like, you know, a kingdom ruled under Cersei would be very different.
Yeah. You know, because they're just saying, you know, he asked, what does Ned has to say about all of this? And it's like, you know, he's our hostage. He will lead no armies while he rots in the dungeon under the Red Keep. And then Tyrion says things had gotten interesting while he's been away. And what is our fearless monarch doing whilst all this butcher's work's being done? How has my lovely and persuasive sister gotten Robert to agree to the imprisonment of his dear friend Ned? It's like, Robert Baratheon is dead. Your nephew reigns in King's Landing.
Yep. Indeed. And then one thing I notice here is, I don't know, for Tywin to be the military genius that he is, like, I'm surprised, well, maybe just because I know what's going to happen in terms of how Rob is going to trick him, but, you know, I would think Tywin would be smart enough to realize, like, young or not, like, Rob Stark is a new opponent. He doesn't know what his strengths or weaknesses are.
Yeah. He's not underestimating someone just because of their age, but he doesn't know what kind of training he has had.
Like, he does, yeah, he should be very, like, neutral and be like, okay, I don't know how good or how inept this kid is, but he's just immediately being like, oh, he's just a little munchkin. And it reminds me of that Dumbledore quote of, age is foolish when it underestimates youth.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
Yeah, because that's also, it's something I've been thinking about as well in terms of as I get older, especially as a woman. And, you know, everyone keeps telling me, oh, you'll appreciate the fact that you look so young as you get older. And I'm in my 30s now, and I still don't feel that appreciation for looking young, because I know there's a correlation with being young and being stupid. And I don't want to be perceived as being stupid.
That's the thing. Yeah, I'm exactly in the same vein. I have, like, you know, big cheeks, which is, you know, from my mom. And my mom has like not looked her age ever. She is about, she's 50, she's in her 50s, and she looks about like in her 40s. And I still look quite young. I still look like I'm in my 20s, mid 20s. Now in my 30s now. And that's the thing, I always think that people think that I'm stupid,
Yeah, and especially as
because
a
I look
woman, you
young.
must also, you're a young woman, so you must also be stupid because you're a woman.
Yeah, that's all of those things.
So Tywin is being very presumptive in this matter when it comes to Ned Stark. Or not Ned Stark, to Robb Stark. And then the clansmen come crashing in.
Well, Tywin wants Tyrion to deal with Beric Dondarrion, because they are, fighting back, and Tyrion says, the gall of them fighting back.
Yeah, the gall.
So then Tywin says, do you think you might be able to deal with them as you scamper off without making too much of a botch of it? And then that's when Shaka comes in, Shaga, not Shaka, Shaga comes in, and saying, don't point your sword at me, saying to one of the Lannisters' guards.
They
And then
all.
his dad is like, what is this? Who are you? And then Tyrion says, they followed me home, father. May I
Can I
keep them?
keep
They
them?
don't eat much. God. Sometimes Tyrion kills me. He's just too funny.
And so the Mountain Men and Stone Crows all introduce themselves, and Tywin is smart enough to like indulge them, very briefly. And it's like, what do you want? A promise of silk and steel. And Tywin's just like,
Horses.
you can have all of that and more if you ride with me against my enemies. And it's like, why should we have to? Like, we have the word of your son. And it's like, I never said it was required. It was a courtesy. And the Mountain Men are like, okay, we'll fight for you, but we're taking Tyrion with us as insurance.
Well, no, it's because he says here, oh, it was just a courtesy. Some of my men are scared of the Winterlands. Even my boldest knights fear to face them. And that's when they're like, we are not fearful of anything, so we're gonna go and fight with you.
Yeah, it's so, I remember reading one article about a Turkish like police investigator was talking about, some of his, cases that he's worked on and how easy it is to get men to confess to murder in comparison to women. Because, and especially in that sort of, very patriarchal like Middle Eastern culture in Turkey, where it's just like, he can manipulate and feed into men's like bravado and ego to admit to doing things. Whereas women, just are so much sneakier and just don't give anything away. Yeah, so
That's the way
again.
that we had to be, that we have to be sometimes, People don't realize the amount of crap that goes on in our heads, that we have to be like so calculating about certain things just to be able to live,
To exist.
just to be able to survive. Just as we were saying, the way we speak, we have to adjust the way that we speak so we are not, are deemed bitches or bossy or whatever. But then there's also the fact that we also have to be firm enough so people don't think that we are flirting with them. And the way that we dress, we always have to think, overthink what we're going to be dressed so people take us seriously, but also that people don't think we're too uptight, but also the fact that we don't get raped on the street. So, that we are constantly having to have, these thoughts in our heads and calculating things in our heads that, yeah, it does make sense that, it's easy to. Because men, I think, lead an easier life in that sense.
And so Tywin is just, playing into their, bravado and toxic masculinity. And during all this, they get a note that says, like, Robb Stark is marching down the road to meet us. And Tywin is like, Tyrion notices he never smiles. He never ever smiles, but he can tell that his father is like happy and pleased. And he's like, so the wolfling is leaving the den to play among the lions.
Yeah.
Yep.
Again, just very underestimating him.
And just going to meet them. And even not Kevin or someone is just like, shouldn't we just wait for them to come to us?
I think it was Kevin. Yeah.
Yeah. Kevin is just like, shouldn't we wait for them to come to us? And it's like, he may chicken out and retreat. You need to like nip this in the bud while he's still, you know, marching towards us.
Yeah. They think it's going to be an easy thing. It's like, oh, let's just do this and then go home.
Let's just do this. Pick up some milk on the way home and then go home.
Exactly. Yeah. We can be done by breakfast tomorrow.
Yep. And then they said, Stone Crows will go with you. We will ride with you, Lion Lord. But only if your half-man son goes with us. He has bought his breath with promises until we hold the steel he pledged us. His life is ours. Lord Tywin turned to his gold-flecked eyes on his son. Joy, said Tyrion said with a resigned smile.
Yeah.
Which I just kind of forgot, because I actually, oh, joy. Like, that's something I would use a lot in my childhood. Like, just the idiolect, the sort of dialect on the West Coast. But I've kind of lost it. I haven't used joy in that sort of sarcastic way in a really long time.
I can't imagine you as a kid just being like, oh, joy. Just so disenfranchised about everything as a little child already.
Yeah, I was a very sarcastic child.
You do well over here.
I was very sassy.
You do very well over here.
Yeah, I think I would do well with the British banter.
Mm-hmm. You would.
Yeah, well,
but it
can
be cutting, so be careful. I don't partake in banter because I can't take it.
Yep. And thus is the end of our three chapters. Yay! Mm-hmm. Picking up. And then the next exercise we have is history lessons. What was yours?
So mine was based off Robb Stark. Because, you know, she's saying, Catelyn is saying, you know, how he's only 15 and
Alexander the Great was only 16 taking over Central Eurasia.
Mm-hmm. So I thought, who was the youngest person to command an army or to go to war or whatever? Yep. And I found this on Quora. It was an answer by Achilles Pitt. I'm so sorry. If you're ever listening, and I'm so sorry for butchering your surname, Pilalamari, and he has written many articles on ancient history. So he said that the person that comes to mind is a guy called Shah Ismail I, who went on to found the Safavid Empire in Persia. And so he was born in 1487. In the ruling family of the Safavi Sufi in order in northwest Iran, which is now Azerbaijan. After his father and brother were killed at a young age, he began leading armies in 1499. So that would make him only 12 years old. As the head of a mystical Sufi order, he commanded the veneration of many tribal leaders at the time. The core of these troops were called the Kizilbash, or redheads, who became the military elite of Iran and Afghanistan in the next few centuries. In 1500, at the age of 13, Ismail won his first major battle against Shirvan, the country that was responsible for the death of his family. In 1501, at the age of 14, he captured Tabriz and ruled the whole of the northwestern Iran, Azerbaijan. And the next year, he declared himself Shah of Iran. In 1510, he had conquered the entire Iranian plateau, defeated the Uzbeks, who were invading from the east, and conquered Iraq. Unfortunately for him, he was defeated by the Ottoman army at Chowdiran in 1514 and lost Iraq but kept the rest of his territories. Despite this, by the age of merely 23, he had conquered Iran and established a 200-year dynasty of enormous historical importance to this day, because this Safavid dynasty is responsible for the conversion of Iran to Shia Islam, which is obvious of major importance today.
Yay! My husband would be so happy with your history example because he is Persian. Shah Ismail did lots of stuff really young. And, you know, he said because modern day Azerbaijan used to be part of, you know, classical traditional Persian empire. And, you know, you said the Shirvans that he fought against. I have been in Baku, Azerbaijan. I have visited and have been in the palace of the Shirvan Shahs.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah.
The culture is amazing. But can you imagine, like, at 12, the guy is just, like, going to war. It's insane.
Yes. And, yeah, the Safavids were a very powerful empire. And it's interesting, like, you know, how the Safavids, like, you know, in that time, you know, they're, like, called one of the major three gunpowder empires, just when gunpowder was starting to be introduced into warfare. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, the Safavids were, like, you know, oh, like, you know, there's no honor in, like, shooting your opponent with a gun from a long distance. You need to go out, fight him with a sword and be manly. And then, you know, that, but also you die.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, just that whole, you know, ideological, you know, military ethics of, you know, emerging technologies like gunpowder.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
But I have been to those places in Azerbaijan. I miss it. I was supposed to go on one more business trip to Azerbaijan, and then the pandemic hit, and I was like, boo. And then I moved to, like, the Arabic program, not the Turkish, out of the Turkish one. So no more Azerbaijan.
That's right. It looks very pretty there.
It's very clean, which is so nice. Mm. It is it's a post-Soviet police state, but, you know.
Right, yeah. So what was your history lesson?
My history lesson comes from the attempted poisoning of Daenerys.
Okay.
And so I just, you know, pulled up a bunch of, you know, from Wikipedia, just list of near fatal poisonings.
Okay. Right.
So, I like it. Yeah, there's basically it's organized in, like, fatal, the ones that succeeded, non-fatal, and alleged. And so here's, I think I'm just going to read the non-fatal ones. And, of course, you know, in Russian history, that advisor that Queen Alexandria had, you know, Rasputin.
Oh, yeah. Rasputin.
Yeah, and then there's, you know, has one of the best villain songs of any animated movie in The Dark of the Night in Anastasia. Oh. Yeah. So, you know, the whole, like, mystique around Rasputin is because it took so long for him to die. Because basically, he survived being poisoned with potassium cyanide. Mm-hmm. And he will, like, on top of that, he survived being shot, bludgeoned, and being thrown into a frozen river. And then he finally died by drowning, not even specifically dying of, like, hypothermia. He, like, it took forever to find him. And again, that's why there's so much, like, you know, mythos around this guy, both in his, like, psychological cunning of how he was able to manipulate the Empress to, like, basically think he had all these, like, you know, special mystical powers, but then that was just enhanced by the fact that it took so long for him to finally die.
That's crazy. You know what, it just makes so much sense, like the cartoon, the fact that, like, he's just falling apart. That's exactly what I just imagined when you were telling me all these things that he survived, and I was like, the man is just falling apart.
Yeah, like, literally.
Wow, crazy.
So that is one attempted poisoning, and then there's Claire Booth Luce. She fell ill from an arsenic poisoning in 1956, but did not die. What's her anymore? She was American, a politician, U.S. ambassador, and public conservative figure. Politically, she was leading conservative in later in life and was well known for anti-communism in her youth. And so, yeah, so I guess someone had tried to poison her, but she did not die. Mm-hmm. And then we have Nikolai Kukalov, poisoned by radioactive thallium in Germany in 1957 for refusing to work as a KGB assassin.
Oh my god. Jesus.
Yeah. Alexander Dubček, Slovak politician, survived an attempt to poison him with strontium-90 in 1968.
Wow.
We have Hafizullah Amin, the second president of Afghanistan, he survived a poisoning by a Soviet agent in 1979.
These people, I wonder, I can only go outside and I'll get COVID. Like, how are these people surviving this?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I'm just reading from a list. Like, I'm sure they would give more detail if I went into every single one. But yeah, I think there's just, you know, whether either they didn't ingest enough of it, or it was contaminated, or like Danny, it was like almost it was averted before they consumed anything.
Yeah.
But what else we got? We've got Hafizullah, second president. Zhu Ling, a Chinese university student, poisoned with thallium in 1995.
Wow.
Khalid Mashal, leader of Palestinian fundamentalist organization Hamas, survived being poisoned by Israeli assassins in 1997 after two of the assassins were captured and an antidote was supplied by Israel in exchange for their release.
Wow. And when was this?
Oh, Khalid. This was in 1997.
Okay.
Yeah, and then Anna Politkovskaya, Russian journalist, poisoned during a flight to Beslan in 2004. Like, why are they all Russian? Why did the KGB need to poison everyone?
I mean, it's not just the KGB.
No.
Just saying. Don't come for me, Putin. I am just a normal person. I'm just saying. Allegedly.
And then Viktor Yushchenko, Ukrainian politician, poisoned with dioxin during the 2004 Ukrainian electoral campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Again, whether we're going to go into World War III over Ukraine, we'll see.
Yeah, let's keep an eye out on that. Not scary at all.
Yeah, Viktor Kalashnikov, Russian ex-KGB colonel. Both he and his wife survived being poisoned with mercury in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
He's a freelance journalist and a former KGB colonel. Oh, that's why, you know, he was treated in Germany for mercury poisoning in what's said to have been an attempt on their lives by Russian FSB, the successor to the KGB. He is a distant relative to Mikhail Kalashnikov, the inventor of the AK-47.
That's scary.
Yes. Yeah. Again. Again. Those former military become journalists. They're the most dangerous.
Yeah.
Like my husband. not much. Not that my husband just did his like quote unquote normal 2-year military service, as a lot of Middle Eastern men have to do in those countries. But yeah.
That's like, are you trying to tell me something?
Yep. And then we've got Vladimir Karamurza, who Russian opposition politician, poisoned in 2017, also possibly in 2015 with an unknown toxin.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he served as vice chairman of Open Russia, NGO founded by Russian businessman and former oligarch Mikhail Kordashevsky, which promotes civil society and democracy in Russia. Oh, heaven forbid. Like,
I know.
Like, an autocracy that tyranny hates is civil society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, why do you think Putin has been in power for so long?
Yeah. And then with the last one on the non-fatal list are Sergei and Yulia Skripal, Russian former double agent and his daughter, poisoned in 2018 in Salisbury, England with nerve agent.
You know what's really funny? So then when they captured the people who did it, they were like, why were you in Salisbury? And then they were like, because of the cathedral.
The cathedral, like something really, really stupid.
Yeah, it was the cathedral. And it's just like, really? You come here for the cathedral? It's just like, it's dodgy.
Yeah, I remember that. That was recent, but technically the before times in the... That was almost as bad, as cringeworthy as when, you know, the people who, you know, the Saudis who chopped up that journalist in the embassy, the embassy in Ankara, and like, you know, being questioned afterwards.
Honestly. Yeah, there's even like a TV show about the poisoning.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, that's my history lesson of the use of poison to try and deal with one's enemies, which interesting notion in history because, again, it's, again, in the medieval Game of Thrones world, it's viewed as craven, it's viewed as the woman's weapon, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. But it, again, like gunpowder, it's like it is the more cunning, less quote-unquote heroic thing, but it also is the most effective and efficient.
I mean, is it? Because you just said attempted. No, none of these people have died, so you never know.
Yeah, well, again, well, and that's the thing. Well, if you're gonna resort to poisoning, then you're more concerned with, like, anonymity. Anonymity than, like, the actual success of it. Because, again, there can be so many variables, just like with Danny, who didn't end up drinking any of it.
Yeah, that is true.
Which is why there are so many KGB examples, because, you know, they put more stock in, like, secrecy.
They love it.
Yeah, like, not that they don't want to, you know, succeed in killing their targets, but they're not willing to just shoot them in the middle of the street.
Yeah, like, it would be back in the day, because it wasn't, like, Stalin going back to Russia, since most of this list was Russian. But if you go back to Stalin, Stalin didn't hide what he was doing.
Yeah, no, he didn't at all. In fact, I was just reading an article about, speaking of Stalin, about all the centers, there are all these, like, pockets in Russia where Stalin's former gulags were, and all of those populations, like, around those historical sites are all super, are pretty wealthy and very educated.
Funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
How ironic.
Yeah. Anyway, on that happy note, let us move on to the friendship lessons.
Bit difficult
what was yours?
This week.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I found it a bit difficult. I don't think there was many, I guess, well, maybe drawer. But I'm going to go with a very unlikely person to choose for a friendship lesson. And that was Liza.
Oh. You know?
Liza, who just refused to send in her army for the mess the captain has made. So my friendship lesson is know when to put your foot down.
Oh, this is true.
Yeah, I think that she realizes that. Well, she does realize when Catelyn came in with Tyrion, she was like, "What the hell are you doing? You're leading these people to my house, to my gates." So she doesn't want anything to do with it. And I think that, you know, just create boundaries with your friends. If they go to war with someone, don't follow them if you don't think it's right.
Yeah.
So that's it.
Oh, nice. My lesson comes from Catelyn, so friendship lessons from both the Tully sisters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my friendship lesson comes from, you know, the typical don't be selfish, like be considerate of other, your friends and other people's best interest over your own. And in that, you know, when Catelyn demonstrating that she is able to contain her quote unquote motherly coddling to, like, you know, do what's best for Rob in the moment, because even though she doesn't like it, she understands that even if not immediately, at least, right, you know, Rob will need the respect of his bannermen, and if she sends him home back to Winterfell like a naughty child with no supper, that they'll just laugh at him forever.
Yeah.
So she, you know, contains her own personal desire and wishes and lets Rob be Rob the Lord.
She realizes that's his duty now, so
yeah. And again, because there's so much else at stake.
Great.
Alrighty then, that thus concludes this episode of Podcaster's Landing. Tune in next time and we shall go over, what is it, what do we got?
Sansa.
We've got Sansa, Ned, and Catelyn again. Alrighty then.
Poor
catch
Ned.
You guys. Yeah, poor Ned. Catch you guys later. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Podcaster's Landing. The music to our intro is copyrighted by Persian-German composer Ramin Djawadi. This podcast is but one of the many shows produced by Sophia Mare Studios. You can get the latest news by following our social media, Sophia Mare Studios on Instagram, Sophia Mare Studios on TikTok, and SophiaMare_pods on Twitter. You can connect with other listeners through the Sophia Mare Studios Discord server. You can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/SophiaMare Studios. Higher tiers get access to even cooler perks. That was the Sophia Mare Studios podcast.